It's Toronto Sportsman Show time, and this year, we're part of the entertainment. And by we mean the entire Outdoor Journal Radio and Fishing Canada crew. That's right, the entire crew will be in-house, hosting live podcasts with guests, interacting with listeners, and fielding questions from our audience all weekend long, March 14th to the 17th. Tickets are on sale now, and fans of our show are getting 15% off their admission price by purchasing with the link in our bio. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to spend a weekend with us at Canada's premier event for outdoor enthusiasts.
Welcome back to the Ugly Pike Podcast on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network. Today's episode is brought to you by Canada's only specialized pike and muskie shop, Izoco. Head over to izocofishing.com and check out all the amazing hand-picked, top-quality gear they have to offer. This episode is also proudly brought to you by Angling Sports, based in London, Ontario, and serving customers throughout Canada and the Northern U.S. With over 30 years of unmatched angler support, they offer top-tier fishing products catering to every skill level. Explore their offerings at anglingsports.ca and gear up for an unparalleled fishing experience. So welcome back to our fishing exploration with Mr. John Pencil. If you haven't already listened to part one, episode 166, please head over to iTunes and download it now and get yourself caught up. In part two, we're going to dive deeper into the technical intricacies that make John such a standout angler. For mastering boat control, precision presentation, and leveraging, that's the word, cutting-edge technologies like LiveScope and front-facing sonar. John's expertise, clearly from this discussion, is unparalleled. We welcome this second chapter of our conversation with John. Hope you enjoy.
Hey, Chris, it's been almost an hour. It seems like it's been 10 minutes.
You haven't even got into the, like, how to catch muskie.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a whole other section. Like, that's the whole other is part two, really. And I don't know if we can get into it. Can we start at least?
I think we can, Chris. And I think let's lead this off. Let's preface it with, John had a footnote in his bio that he sent us, and it really stuck out at me. And he said, nothing we do is random.
Okay. Wait. I'm glad you said that. I took a bigger context. I actually want to read what he wrote, 'cause I love it.
Okay.
And when read it, John, I was like, wow, this is awesome. I'm going to keep this whole paragraph, 'cause it defines so much about muskie angling. And you can learn so much from it. So I'm going to read it if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I'm primarily a caster the majority of the season, but there's never a time we aren't willing to cast, jig, or troll. And any of those tactics can take over a day, a trip, a month, at any time during the season. I pride myself on boat control and precision presentation while I'm casting, trolling, or jigging. Nothing we do is random. Baits are never just haphazardly dropped out the back without knowing where they are. And it's rare that we're just casting as far as we can into nothing without knowing exactly where an edge is or placing a cast strategically along the structure. In my opinion, presentation is everything in musky fishing. I mean, just to unpack that is an hour right there, because you touch on so many foundational key points and how to fish for muskie. And I don't know where to start, but I just want to appreciate that you put the time in to write that, because it really shows your in-depth knowledge and your intuition of muskie fishing. So Frank, I don't know if you want to jump in with a question.
I do. I want to jump in just maybe with a statement and say, like, you also talked about live scope and you said, well, I don't sharpshoot fish. I use it to gauge the depth of my baits and where they're running. and relative to structure and all that sort of thing, or bottom or whatever it is that you're running your baits over. And that's important, because I've done that before, and it's really neat to see. Excuse me. And I think what I want to say right now is, if this is part of the allure to trolling for me especially, is that the science, the calculations and all that sort of thing, you have to be a scientist mixing ingredients at precise locations and precise amounts rather. And, you know, if you buy a crankbait and you don't ask the maker of that crankbait what the dive curve is, you're doing it wrong. You're at a disadvantage right out of the gate. You should know the dive curve of everything you're doing. It's really, really important. And then you have to factor in things like the angle of your rod, the speed of your vessel, and that sort of thing. And it's all this, you know, recipe for success. And any one of those variables can bring that bait lower or higher in the water column. So you have to be a real scientist to be an effective troller and to run these baits properly. I don't know what my point was, but, you know, going off of what you said, Chris, I mean, I think it's funny that you and I both picked the same kind of it was a great bio. It wasn't a typical bio like we get, right? Usually get some bullet points and I do this and I do that and blah, blah, blah. This was more like a story that was John's philosophy of fishing.
Yeah. So John, yeah, if I'm a listener and I want to ask you, it's like, maybe elaborate on that. Like, how do you define precision presentation? And maybe elaborate on how, like, what specific techniques or adjustments that you make during casting or trolling or jigging to ensure that you strategically get your bait where you want it, as you said. And as Frank mentioned, you have all these variables that you have to calculate. So if there's a way to, like, dumb it down for us and the listeners in terms of, like, this most simplest way to explain how you approach incorporating all these factors into your calculation, then, you know, let us hear your perspective on that.
All right. You know what? There's a good reason why I feel that precision is the most important part in any of it. Yes, people will say that the key is time on the water, right? The key is just being out there. But if you think back even to, like, your steelhead days, you know, fishing a tributary, I used to play a game when I fished the tribs. We were very early into the center pin game and float fishing. And the game that I would play is, even when there was 100 people down there catching steelhead and you could see them shoulder to shoulder all around you, my game was, I wanted to catch more fish myself than every single person that I could see combined. And if I did that, I won the game. Mm. And now we all put in the same amount of time out there. Mm. So the one thing that would make me more effective than them is my presentation. So if I could do that, right, the way that I had planned and have that perfect presentation, as long as I was the only one doing that, it was easy to win the game. Now, years went by and more people bought center pins and they learned from YouTube. And now everyone has that presentation. And now it's almost impossible in the game because everyone catches four or five fish instead of one guy catching 60 and everyone else catching one or two. And that's why I ran away from steelhead, because I can't just be the best in the world at it anymore. So I when I got into muskie fishing, we kind of brought that mindset. Like, there's a way to be better at it and more effective at it, and that's your presentation. If you're out there for 12 hours in the late fall and your bait's only down 6 feet and those fish are lethargic and they don't want to come up off the bottom, you're wasting your time. Yeah. But if you're precision enough in your presentation, in your trolling presentation, you can keep those baits a foot off the bottom, especially through those key areas, those key feeding shelves or ambush points, then you become far more effective than anyone else around you. And I never fear a crowd because of that reason. I know that the majority of the people out there, you say, where's your bait at? Oh, it's back 130 feet. And that's all they know. They just know that it's back there. They don't know how deep that even puts them. And I see that when I put people in my boat, even bait makers. You'll say, hey, listen, put your bait down 10 or put your bait down 14. And then you drive for 20 minutes and you notice that their bait is just weeded out 6 times because it's down further than you told them to. And now they're smashing into weed beds, or they're smashing into the bottom and they picked up debris. And so knowing those things so you can fish what you want to fish, your target areas, successfully, It's everything. And with casting, that's the same. I mean, if you can hit those areas in a precise fashion, and a lot of that was fishing them multiple times, so you knew the structure, you knew exactly where the weed edge was, you knew exactly where the rocks and the high points were, so you can lay that bait right down on the edge and then work it down the slope gradually as you bring it back to you and know, you know, how deep you need to get that bait upon your retrieve. And a lot of that, it took time on the water to learn that and be precise with that and know your casting baits and your retrieves.
So John, just to cut in. So you're talking about one aspect of the presentation, your depth. Now, what about the other aspects like size, color, retrieve? Like, is that all part of the presentation as well for you? Like you go from one to the next, to the next. If the depth is okay, then you look, if you're not getting any success, you go to a color change or you go to a size change or a complete lure change. Is that the kind of process you go through?
Absolutely. I mean, you're always trying to figure that out as fast as you can on a trip, right? Like, so if you're on your first day of your trip and you have a good angler with you as a partner, everybody should be trying to cycle through past successful baits, right? Or maybe throw something new into the mix, but you're trying to narrow down something that they're going to eat all week. And the faster you can find that bait that's going to be your guy for the next few days, the better your week's going to be. Mm-hmm. And if you can't find that, right? If you're in day three and you're still, the bait pile is growing on the deck, right? Like, now there's 20 different baits laying there. Odds are it wasn't a good week. And if you can't turn it around quick, it's not going to be good. So, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it is trying to know what bait to use and when. But I mean, that does take time on the water, right? I mean, to know those presentations takes a little time on the water or a little research. I mean, it takes, you know, being able to read 30 years worth of data from the NMA or reading articles and knowing what works at what temps or what worked for, you know, Mike Hulbert or Spencer Berman on St. Clair, or what worked for Johnny Dadson on Georgian Bay, and then taking it and adapting it to your fishery, because everything works everywhere, right? I mean, in a way. And if you can be the first guy that brought it to a new fishery, or if you could be the one that the first guy that maybe showed it to those fish, you can have, you know, all that success. I mean, the Red October guys seen that, right? Yeah. I mean, they brought tubes to new places after they brought them to the Niagara, or the first time that they jigged tubes on the Niagara. I mean, it's the results that they seen because they gave a new presentation and a very effective presentation. They got to see something that no one had ever seen before. And it's always the next guy that's willing to do something different or present something in a perfect manner that the fish just can't resist it. And they're going to have that ultimate success. They're going to have that new fish feeling, right? Dumb new fish that have never seen a bait. You can experience that again if you could find, you know, a new presentation or a new bait that they just haven't seen. It makes the fish dumb all over again.
So, John, you mentioned there's never a time when you aren't willing to cast, jig, or troll. So can you give us a scenario how you quickly kind of adapted your fishing strategy from casting over to trolling or vice versa? And what were the factors that made you make that change? Because it sounds like something will trigger you to, and you're willing at any time to make that strategic change because an indicator or something has caused you to make this change. And so maybe walk us through why that would happen.
All right, I'll give you a couple of examples.
Especially to trolling, because you admitted that you're not primarily a troller. So this is very interesting.
So, we'll start with the Niagara. So typically on the Niagara, if I'm fishing at night, I'm going to cast or troll. And that's at any time of the year. I love the night troll there. We do very well doing it. Come late season, if it's during the day, if the water is dirty on the Niagara, again, we'll cast or troll, primarily trolling. When the water is dirty on the Niagara in the fall, it fishes a lot like it does at night. The fish come a little higher in the water column. They're more apt to eat a troll bait. So it'll change your presentation and what your tactics would be just on that. The other factor is wind direction, right? Jigging on the Niagara is probably the most effective way to catch big fish during clear water periods that the Niagara has ever seen. But if the wind is blowing from the northwest, it doesn't matter how clear the water is because it destroys your presentation. Like, you just can't get the drift that you need to get the bait in the fish's face the way that it needs to be. Like it'd be the same as trying to float fish a stream or fly fish a stream with a, you know, 30 mile an hour wind coming upstream. You just can't get the bait to do what it needs to, mm-hmm. to look realistic in the water column and be presented to them in the way it needs to be. So I'll take those, right? If I go out on a day and it starts out perfect conditions and I'm jigging my way down, you know, Lunge Lane in the West River of the Niagara, and things are perfect for 2 hours and maybe we get a bite or two and catch a fish or two, but then the wind shifts and now it's a northwest blow, I could sit there and try to stick out that jigging all day, but we're just wasting our time. Like if we want to sit there and jig because we're jiggers, you're wasting your time. You have to know when to give it up, break out the trolling sticks and give them something presented in a fashion that they're going to want to eat it. You can't just fish how you prefer to fish all the time. You have to adapt.
John, when you're trolling, are you only going in one direction on that river?
I'm actually doing a seminar for Muskies Canada next week for the Kitchener-Waterloo chapter. Yeah. And that's one of the slides that I put in there is ways that you troll on the Niagara. There's a few different schools of thought on that. You got guys like Frank DeMarcantonio that always believed in the downstream crunch. In years, he'd watch Frank. He'd run all the way up. He'd put his baits down, and he would just smash them into the bottom straight down. Traditionally, that's known as a smaller fish tactic there, especially in the fall. It's tough to get slowed down to the speeds that you need to do, but the bait's in the right spot, right? If the fish are feeding near the bottom and you're just slamming it into the zebra beds or, you know, the soft bottom that's down there or hard bottom in the shoal spots, you know, 18 to 25 feet deep, your baits are in the right spot. So you're gonna get a fish to eat them. The other school of thought is just to go directly into the current and try to get the bait at the depth that it needs to be. Now, doing that, you can kind of slide back and forth. You can make your bait dance behind humps. So knowing where the humps are is key in that. For us, 90% of our fish are caught trolling cross current. And what you're doing when you troll cross current is you're sliding across the river without losing ground. So your boat's almost at an angle. Your bait action is faster than the boat's actually moving because the current's against the lip. So even though the boat might only be sliding at 2.5 miles an hour, the bait's down there moving back and forth like you're doing 4 miles an hour. So you can go slower than a traditional musky approach would be on say, Georgian Bay.
Yeah, but John, how do you reconcile the depth of the bait? So Brent Pochek does this. He told us on our show a while back that this is how he trolls. But like for me, because you know as well as I do, like the river's like this, right? So you've got, you know, tiers almost that go into the bottom basin, if you will. So it's tough to run your bait at a deep bait because then the deeper your bait, the narrower your back and forth has got to be. So how do you reconcile that? Do you just keep it shallow and just run the entire river back and forth, or do you keep it deep and run a narrow zigzag?
No, we'll identify our feeding points. Okay. Traditionally, Niagara fish, they'll eat in a few different spots, right? They'll eat at like 18 feet 90% of the time, or they'll eat at that 14-foot ledge. So if I want to target that 14-foot ledge, basically I'll be doing cross-current passes from maybe 12 to the 18. So I'll put that bait down 12 feet.
Okay.
And I'll go in towards that 12, and when I reach it, I'll make the turn and I'll head back out, you know, across. And then when I get out to that 18, I'll turn and I'll head back in. And maybe it is just a short cross current pass with lots of turns, but those fish are going to eat a lot of times as the bait comes off, right? Because they sit off the shelf. So as that bait comes out of 12 into 14, maybe that fish is just sitting on that first little ledge and they go vertical on the bait and they eat it from underneath. And it's very, very repeatable. And part of that is just figuring out where they're set up, right? I mean, they're definitely pack hunters on the Niagara. Like when you find a fish, sometimes you can find a group. And I've had some really, really crazy experiences because of that, especially when new fish may move in from the lake or when fish post-spawn might set up in one little area on their way out. We've had some really, really amazing nights and amazing days just because of the fact that they tend to condense into one little area. So once you can kind of identify where they are, if you know how to use your electronics, that helps. Live mapping all helps. I mean, all those things are kind of shortcuts to doing what the old timers did years and years ago when they would just look at a tree up there and know where to turn. You know, those guys would line up buoys and lights in the skyline and use those to make their turns as they worked up through the structure. And I mean, us with live mapping, we can almost cheat, you know, we can see where the humps are and, yeah. and how to drag the bait right behind a hump or right along a ledge. And it's a cheat code. It really is.
Well, if anyone can get Johnny into a boat on the Niagara, it's going to be you. I think for shits and giggles, why don't we jump out onto the water this year and pick a day that you think might be a good one or a night that you think might be a good one, and we'll both twist his arm. Let's just go have some fun.
Yeah, for sure. I probably could have got him out there this fall, and then, you know, weather falls apart and you've got five guys that you had promised trips to, and it gets tough sometimes, man.
Yeah.
You have 20 guys you want to spend time with in the boat, and there's only room for a few, you know?
Dude, I hear you. That's everybody we interview, we're like, yeah, let's fish together, and then it's really tough. But you know what? We're all locals here, so it might be a little easier to put this one together, and there's no travel and nothing like that. I'm super flexible. Johnny can be flexible.
For sure.
Yeah, we'll make it work.
I did have another example of when I would adapt. I remember years ago, probably 5-6 years ago, me and Cullen were out east, and it was a nasty, like, northeast blow. Like, there was a weird chop, and I was kind of having to drag the boat into the current because that's against the current there. And we were casting, and it was a tough bite, but I had the boat off maybe in like 18 to 20, and we started to see fish. Just on 2D sonar, there was a ton of life right on the bottom in that 18 to 20 and some big marks. I mean, you know, we worked through these areas 3 or 4 times and we're casting, and we're just not seeing anything. And at one point I bombed the tube out to the middle, let it sink to the bottom and worked it back to the boat. And, I got like a 49 inch fish or something like that. And I remember thinking, man, there's something to that. Like, those fish are somewhat active, even though it's in northeast and they should all be laying down. I said, but there's a lot going on deep. And all of a sudden, I look back at Cullen at one point, and he's just standing on the back of the boat, dead sticking a 7.5-inch tube. And I can see what he's doing. He's basically trolling the tube because I'm dragging us, you know, at 1.5 miles an hour, dead into the wind to even get us to go that direction. And I'm watching him, and I'm like, you know what? It looks like the stupidest thing in the world, but I bet you it's going to work. And it wasn't too much longer later. Like, next thing I know, he's hooked up, and he lost a couple fish in a row, and the one was an absolute Goliath. He fought the thing quite a while, lost it right at the boat, and I've probably never seen him so angry at a fish. And I think it was because he beat the fish, right? Like, he did everything that needed to be done to get the thing into the bag, and he won the battle. And then right at the end, the fish just kind of shook its head a little bit and flipped his tube like, ah, the joke's on you, man. I had the upper hand the whole time. And right after that, he got another fish that was 53.5 inches, and we put it in the bag, and I was like, It was a consolation prize because the one he had was quite a bit bigger. He's thicker anyway.
53-inch consolation prize. Oh, yeah. I wish I had that problem.
On the freaking Niagara? Are you kidding me?
No. That was out east.
Man. Oh, I got you. Okay. I feel better now. Holy shit.
Yeah.
I was going to slip my wrist there for a sec.
No, you know what? The Niagara, all the years and hundreds of fish that we've caught, the Niagara has never been known for 50-inch fish. In fact, this year, there were more 50-inch fish caught in the Niagara by club members than any other year in history. Now, the harbor is known for 50-inch fish, but the Niagara never was and probably never really will be. But I've caught 4 personally ever. Cullen's probably got 5 or 6 maybe. And I've only had 5, 6, maybe 7 in my boat. And my buddy, 3 of them were from this year. I got 2 in one night in November. And my buddy Kevin McGaffick back in June, his first jigging fish ever ended up being a beautiful 50-incher.
Nice. Yeah. Really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's cool to see those fish grow up like that. It is. I didn't catch a ton of fish in the Niagara this year. I think I had like maybe 18 fish to the boat from the Niagara, but like 7 or 8 were over 48.5. I mean, it's pretty cool to see that, you know.
Really neat. It's great to hear too. And like I said, after looking at some of the data sets, I was a little discouraged, but I'm a little more plugged into the community now on the Niagara, and it seems like it was a bit of a rebound year. So let's hope that's a trend.
No, I agree, man. Hopefully, hopefully these little ones that are showing up will just continue to keep it going, and we'll have another wave in 10 years, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear, from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Ange and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing. Me and Garth and Turk and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things free, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
or you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No matter what species you love to target, from boot to headlamp, Angling Sports has what you need. Their store is massive, and it's just loaded with equipment and apparel. So if you love to go after those big toothy critters like we do, it's a one-stop shop for all pike and muskie tackle. Whether you're looking for trolling rods or casting reels, Angling Sports is always adding the latest and best industry offerings from entry level to higher end. Looking for custom muskie baits? They got them. It's worth the drive to London, so check out their amazing store in person or online by visiting anglingsports.ca and net that PB in style.
Chris, ask me what time it is.
Frank, tell us the time. Tell us exactly what time it is.
It's Toronto Sportsman Show time. Did you know that?
I had a feeling you were going there.
And this year, we are part of the entertainment. And by we, I just want to mention this, Chris. It's the entire Outdoor Journal Radio and Fishing Canada crew. Entire crew is going to be in-house hosting live podcasts with guests at the Toronto Sportsman Show, interacting with listeners, fielding questions all weekend long. It's March 14th to the 17th. So if you guys want to get tickets now, you can get 15% off your admission price by purchasing the link in our social media bio. So check out those links and don't miss an incredible opportunity to spend a weekend with us at the Canada's premier event for outdoor enthusiasts. So that's what time it is, guys. And it's also time. Geez, Chris, we got maybe another 15, 20 minutes or so. So I have a feeling you still have points to get to.
I've got 2 hours to talk to him about, but here's a quick segue. All this precision presentation and all the stuff you talk about, you touched on the cheat code for the technology today. So precision, I can say it, presentation implies that you have like a deep understanding of the underwater environment and structure. So maybe explain how you leverage this new technology versus the traditional methods to identify, you know, the underwater structure and features that are crucial for you to kind of understand where you're putting your lures and where you're targeting fish now, because we know it's a game changer. And you mentioned in your kind of your text to us how you utilize that technology in a real effective way in terms of mapping out where you fish, verifying live areas, like really interesting points. So maybe talk a bit how effective that has been for you and your use of it.
Certainly. You know what? I'm going to preface this with saying that I think that everybody should start out at square one, right? Like we started musky fishing from the shore and then did some inland lake stuff in a canoe. And then my 14-foot duck boat we took out with, we had two little 30-pound thrust trolling motors, one at the bow and one at the back. And we would just kind of spin in tight little circles going around and fishing. We had that up on the Niagara and we did well on that little thing. It was a lot of fun, but fishing from those and staying close to the launch and fishing, you know, maybe you'd run to an area, but then you'd have to fish that thoroughly. We thoroughly learned those areas and we learned where they ate and kind of what would make them eat in those spots. And learning that way made us what we are today. Like there's no doubt about that. That being said, the new technology is certainly a shortcut, but it, you can take that technology, you can live map an area, you can use your 2D sonar and your side imaging once you have that dialed in and you understand what you're seeing to verify life and to realize what structure is comprised of, right? So now I can look at that technology and realize, oh, they always ate here because it's a rock pile down there. Where years ago, I had no clue why they ate in that spot. You know, it looked like just the rest of the spots. You know, the entire river was the same in that area, but they ate in one little spot every single time. And then once you see it on side image, you're like, oh, okay, it's that beautiful, perfect, craggly rock that all the life lives in. And when you have the technology where it's at today, you can really, really understand that. And where it gets even better is with the forward-facing sonar that we have today, the LiveScope, which there are people against it. There are people for it now. I think people are against it because of the live scope snipers that are out there, the guys that are just driving around targeting fish in open water. I don't do that. It's not my thing. It never will be my thing. I have no desire to just drive around looking for a fish on my electronics and then fish for that one fish. I still and always will fish muskies traditionally and work my way down structure, whether that's casting, trolling, or jigging. Where it helps is on the troll. I can not only see the structure in a live manner and see how it raises and what it's comprised of, having it live mapped, know exactly what my depths are going to be before I get to them, and then being able to use the forward-facing sonar pointed rearward to see where my baits are. I can see the bait as it approaches the structure. At that point, I can bring it up if it's going to hit it. I can drop it down if I'd like it to be a little bit closer. It's an absolute shortcut to knowing what your lure is down there, where before I would have to, like you said, maybe ask a bait maker, what's the depth curve on your lure? Or I have trust issues, so I would go and depth curve them myself. You know, I would go out and I would see how many feet I had to put back on my equipment with my rod and my reel and my rod position to put it where I want it to be for my fisheries. So using LiveScope, I can drop a brand new bait back that I've never used before, that I have no clue what it does, and see exactly where it's at.
And how the fish are reacting. And how the fish are reacting to it. Like you can see the behavior of the fish, which is critical, isn't it?
I had, there was a night 2 years ago, maybe in the fall, that me and my buddy Josh Kane was out. He's one, he works with Hans, you know, part of Buffalo Harbor Outfitters there. Great dude, great angler. But we had a jointed perch bait back and brown perch. And twice a fish came up hot on it, looked at it and turned away. And we're like, all right, well, that fish is active, or these two fish were active. Like something's up. Let's try a color change. And we switched it over to Night Shiner and the next fish swallowed the thing. Is that coincidence? It could have been. But I would have never known those fish followed if it wasn't for the live scope. And I probably wouldn't have made the color change if it wasn't for the live scope. So maybe the live scope caught that fish. Maybe it was coincidence. But I mean, I like to believe that seeing follows and being able to make adjustments because of them is going to put more fish in the bag. And that's just one way that we use it. That's not going around harassing fish and sniping fish like everyone sees LiveScope as. I mean, a lot of guys that dislike it or hate it before they've tried it, that's why they're hating on it, is because they think that is what it is. And it's really not. It's a tool that can be used a ton of different ways. Casting, we use it. I can see how far I am off a weed bed, whether it be watercolor that prevents you from seeing those weeds, or maybe it's, you know, sometimes you get those light conditions where you just can't see the edge. You know, sometimes you could visually see them. Other times you can't see a thing. When I put LiveScope down and I point it towards the structure that I'm casting at, I can see exactly how many feet away that structure is. I can see if there's a shelf in it. I can see if it goes from thick coon tail that you can't cast into to nice strands of cabbage. So maybe I'm casting 30 feet to the same hard edge over and over again. And then all of a sudden I look at the live scope and there's a little window within those weeds where it's beautiful cabbage that goes back an additional 50 feet that I never knew was there unless I had that, because I would just keep casting to that same line as I went down the structure. Now I can bomb that cast back in there, and that for fish hide. I mean, little spots like that, little cracks and crevices are absolutely where they hide. My biggest fish of the season came because of that. We were towards the mouth of Lake Ontario on the St. Lawrence in October, and we decided to start casting before dark, and we were on like our third spot casting around a rock shoal in the middle of the river and just a little exposed rock. And I was casting twin 13s around the back of it, and it had like a gradual fall. I'd never casted this spot before in my life, and I'm working the 13s around the back and just going through, and I could see what I'm casting to because of that live scope, even though I'd never casted it before. So I'm working my bait back, and it's, you know, down 6 feet in the water column, and, you know, looks perfect. And then I got around to the north side of that rock, and it was a sheer drop off, and the 13s just didn't look like the approach that I should have. So I took them off. I put on a 12 inch rover with a number 10 blade up above it, like a spinnerbait style arm, tossed it out and just slow rolled it across the base of that rock, probably down 10 feet. And a fish smashed it, and we put a 55 inch in, and that was a tank, you know. And without that, maybe I leave the 13s on, and that fish never comes up from the depths where it was at, or the little crevice that it hid in the rocks. I mean, it's a tool that you can use to take advantage of so many things. I mean, it just so many changes in structure, and just it's a learning tool that's unbelievable.
But it's exciting. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, you talk about it as a tool, but what you just defined there, you have to be paying attention. Like, it's so important to pay attention to all the little things that you just described. And without paying attention, you are going to miss those little indicators that, you know, allowed you to make those changes or triggered you to make those changes. So just shows you how, like, even though you have the technology, you have to use it appropriately and be in tune with, like, you know, paying attention enough that you can use it to your advantage.
It's hard to look away. Don't you find, like, I find that when you're running baits, especially trolling, it's hard to take your eyes off. You're mesmerized, you know, and you see any movement, you see anything develop behind your bait, and you're on the edge of your chair, and then you do see something come in. You can see that it's got a good body to it. You can see the swaying of the body as the fish kicks its tail, and then when the reel goes off, it's freaking awesome. It's a lot of fun, and it's useful, and I think, you know, there's such a debate right now in the community about live scope. And you know what, John, I think you're really, are onto something here, that we can have this great technology and not abuse it as responsible anglers, just like we're trusted not to abuse the fish, handle them properly, you know, adhere to minimum size requirements for keepers. There's a million things we do as anglers that are in the interest of the fish. And I think this is a great way to ethically use live scope. It's a lot of fun. It's going to up your odds, but you're not out there sharpshooting, putting undue stress on the fish. I think that's great.
Absolutely. It is. It's like you said, it's exciting. I remember one of the times, almost every time that you've ever seen a fish shoot up to eat. I mean, they shoot up off bottom so fast to eat a bait while you're trolling that you kind of lose your mind. Like, you have no choice but to get excited like a little kid. And I remember the one time, like, probably the first time we ever seen one, I just started screaming, down rod, your side. And it was a fish that ate Cullen's bait. And I think he was confused out of his mind why I was screaming down rod. But I seen that then head shaking on the live scope before the rod clicked, you know. So it's kind of unbelievable that when you see it that way. Another time I did the exact same thing. I had Mike Fretold in the boat, and I'm screaming, down rod, your side. And then I realized that his rod never went off. I seen the fish head shake. I seen everything. The fish had eaten a clump of moss on his weed catcher 6 feet in front of his bait. It chose to eat that over his actual lure, which is like, oh, now you're just angry that you've seen it. But it was an experience. This year in the fall, it happened once with me and Cullen, and we were both so excited. We tripped over everything that was in the boat. We smashed our knees on a Lake Woods and basically almost fell overboard because we were so excited to get back there to the rock because it was just such a cool motion on that live scope. But
I mean, if that fish is eating and it comes towards the boat, you're not going to hear the pull, right? You might see that on your live scope, but you're not going to hear a pull if he's coming towards you.
You did. That's one thing that I've noticed on there. Yeah. When you see an eat, that fish eats a full second before you ever hear a click. Your rod usually goes somewhat limp before it actually bends over because they eat it with such much speed. They either take it straight up or they take it towards the boat. I mean, it's wild, you know.
Or if you're fishing with my friend Attila, he never puts the clicker back on. You never hear the thing go off, even when there's a freaking giant fish on the line. Fuck, it's exciting, man. It's exciting. February 13th.
Frank, you might be thinking what I'm thinking is that John would be a perfect guy to have on our round table discussion that we want to have one day about this topic and have a pro and con debate about live scope. And I think, you know, John would be a perfect member on that. Discussion, if and when we have it.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe we just found the answer just now in this show, because it seems to me that, you know, I don't remember where it was, but I remember hearing, maybe it was in a conversation or a meeting or on a show. I don't remember, but I remember hearing Angelo Viola and Pete talking about it, and Angelo just saying, you're just not going to, it's just the way fishing goes. There's technological advancements and people are gonna use them, so get used to it and stop crying about it. But
we talked about it on this show so many times that you can't stop the advent of technology. It's just going to become ubiquitous. It's like the first time you get any leap in the technology, a few people can afford it, it's on a few boats, then all of a sudden it's standard on every boat. It might not be the best version, but some version of it's going to be standard on every boat. But, you know, like, still there is things to talk about in terms of how you use it effectively and how you use it with responsibly, which John has defined.
I think you nailed it. Yeah, I think you really nailed it, John. And it's such a great happy medium and a sensible approach, and it's fun. You know, yeah, I find that we I think Alex sold his live scope, so we don't have it anymore. But when we were using it, we were kind of off and on with it because we just found ourselves, especially on those long night shifts, just eyes bleeding, staring for like hours at a time, staring at this fucking thing, watching our baits. Like, it's hypnotic. What's that, Chris?
Like a Netflix binge. You're just locked in for hours and hours and hours and hours, just staring at the screen.
Yeah,
or it's like, even worse if you get a guy in the boat that he likes to database his baits and like his depth curves, because now he's going to sit there and go through every bait in his box and drop them back to a depth and just say, hey, can you see my guy? Do you see my guy back there? Yeah. When you get a chance, can you see my guy? And then they're going to sit there punching it in. Eventually, you just, you know, turn it off and tell them it broke, so you don't got to do it anymore.
there's something to be said for just looking up into the night sky, looking around, you know, and just taking it all in, especially like for us this year and for you, I'm sure, John, the fall was so mild, right? So it was such a wicked time to fish in Ontario, where we had, you know, September weather all the way through to the end of the musky season. It was great, man. I remember being out east and we were just, you know, layers off, and just it was like September 10th. You know what I mean? It was just awesome. Yeah.
It's funny. You say great. I think it was horrible. My water temps never got where I needed them to be for my pelagic fish to ever show up, for the most part.
So okay. So
I was praying for cold.
Right. So I get that. And I get that. You want those big fish to move in where they're going to move in, and you want to take a stab at them once a year. That part I get. But nonetheless, we had a, maybe not in terms of your standards, but we had a real successful end of the season, and we did that, you know, with really good conditions. And plus, like, the Unleash the Beast tournament in September was like a summer tournament. It was so awesome. I mean, no one caught fish, but it was such a fun time. I thought I heard that you're going to be fishing that one this year. Is that true?
Yeah, Todd talked me into it. Me and Colin are both going to come up there at the end of September. I'm looking forward to it.
It's the best, man. We're going to have such a great time. So I'm glad to hear that. Really cool.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have a great time up there. I didn't want to miss it again. So we'll be up.
Cool, man. Cool. All right, Chris. We wrapping up with a fish story or what?
Yeah, sure. I have, I guess, one question I wanted to pull from John is like, if you could give us three fundamental skills that, like, from his opinion, that every angler starting out in muskie should, you know, practice, master before you get into all the kind of complications with all these different, you know, tools and techniques. Like, what are three things you would recommend as your primary kind of foundational skills to catching muskie?
You know what? You need to know how to work a rubber bait. There's so many guys out there that have never mastered a bulldog or working a tube or working a Medusa. And if once you master that, I mean, you can kind of take over the world. I mean, you can take that skill anywhere and catch fish. And if you can, you can master that. And if it takes booking a guide, listen, if you fish with a guide, you're not fishing with that guide to learn his spots or take his spots. And if you are, you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
Exactly.
You need to book with a guide and you need to learn his specialty, his skill. You need to learn the tactics and pay attention to that. You know what I mean? You might change the way that you approach spots. You might change the way that you work baits, but forget what you know. Don't go in there with, you know, oh, I already know how to work a bulldog. Whatever he says, just do it. Just buy into the program for the day because that's what you're paying for, right? So buy into his program. Do things the way he does them. And for better or for worse, you know, maybe it's a failure, but at least you tried, you know, his tactic for that day because you're that's what you're paying for. You're paying for his knowledge and his skill set. So that's number one. Learn to work a rubber bait. I mean, learn to work a dog. Learn to work a Dusa and then take that everywhere you go and just dominate. Learn to work a tube. You know what I mean? That tube is unbelievable. I mean, there's no better big fish bait on the planet besides maybe blades. And that's number two. Learn to fish blades. Learn to troll blades. Learn to short line blades. And learn different tactics for casting them, whether it's, you know, burning them on Lake of the Woods or slow rolling them in a current presentation where you know what I mean? You got to learn to keep them cross current in the current. That way you can maintain depth. I guess last but not least is pick a couple of trolling baits, whether it be, you know, Mortimer's Kirby's or Cullen's Candies or the, you know, Everlasting Perch bait, you know, Boss Shad, something proven, Depth Raider. Pick a proven bait and learn it inside and out and make it your confidence. And then be able to take that and troll it wherever you go and have success. That's the biggest thing is just having a confidence trolling bait that you know the ins and outs of and understand it up and down and sideways and where to put it down and where to put it back to put it at a depth. And then just use that to catch fish wherever you go and to absolutely dominate.
That's a great point. Yeah, that last one, that's a great point. That was probably the biggest thing I learned from the guys that taught me how to troll was to find that bait. And I found that bait. I was lucky. I found it real quickly. And we call it the king. And the thing's just a magnet. And I feel great when that thing is running. You know what I mean? It's when I'm with these guys in the boat, it's got to be down on one line because it's a puller. So
yeah, when Elvis is back, things are going to happen, right? The king is in the water. You're good.
There you go. There you go.
And John, I mean, something we advocate on the show all the time is guides are not exactly what you said. They're not just like a service that you pay for. It's like part of your trip to show you some spots and get you on fish. It's like you have to treat it as an investment in your fishing, like education and career. So think of it like a professor in a school or whatever. Like you're taking a class, you're trying to learn something. And that's going to increase your knowledge base as you grow as an angler. That's the way you have to look at it. And exactly, I think you defined it perfectly. Like, have that mindset. Buy into the program, whatever it is, whether you agree with it or not, buy into the program because they're doing it because they're experts. So they're doing something better than you. And then I think eventually you put all those pieces together, you just become a better angler, you know, along the way.
Yeah, that's right. And even if it's not something that maybe they're not doing it better than you, but they're doing it different, right?
Yeah.
You got to buy into the way they're doing it because guess what? You might be able to take that somewhere that you fish and just do it that little bit different than you always have. And all of a sudden it just opens up a whole new world. So you really do have to pay attention and just buy into what they have to share with you.
All right. Well, I think we covered a lot, Frank. I think this is a time where we could ask John, for we always ask our guests for a famous fish story that you have in your long career. I'm sure the thousands of hours on the water, you have something you could throw at us.
You know what? I'll stick with this fall. This fall, we just talked about the water temps were kind of tough. I mean, in October, I told you we caught that one big 55, and we caught another 53 trolling later on that night. And then after that, it was the silence of the reels. We were on like Silence of the Reels, season 9, episode 6. And it was just continuing forever at that point. And I think we had like 9 nights without hearing a click at one point. It was, and we're, don't get me wrong, we're fishing super low density water. We're looking for another 59.5, and it just wasn't happening. We weren't finding a 29.5, let alone a 59.5. But, we fished hard, and then, you know, we made it back. You know, now we're on home waters and we're fishing there. And even the Niagara wasn't quite right. It was just resident fish. Nothing had came in. And finally, one night, I think it was actually November 20th, we seen it was like a prefrontal window. There had been some wind a couple of days prior. It was a decent moon phase, nothing crazy. It wasn't noon. It wasn't full, but it was one of those ones where you had a nice little spike in the activity if you follow the lunar tables. And so we went out for the major, which fell right at sunset that night. And we get out there, and like the first pass through, we can see that there's life. You know, we're working our way along a ledge in the upper Niagara, and there's life. And we've seen a couple of fish that were big just on 2D. I think we've seen one on side imaging, and we ran a couple right over on the ledge, like right where that 18 goes to 14 foot. And so now you're excited, but our first time through, you know, our first approach doing those cross current paths, we were bottoming out our baits. I think we had them down 14, and they were biting bottom, and there were still some remnant weeds on the bottom because it had been so warm.
Yeah.
And so it just wasn't right. So I it kind of clicked in my head that it had been an east wind for 2 days. And anybody that's used to east winds on Lake Erie, there's that seiche effect. All the water will get pushed to the other end of the lake. So water levels were actually down like 2 feet. So my live mapping where it was showing me I was in 14, it was actually 12. So Ryan Klein a couple of years ago taught me the trick where you use the depth offset in your graph. You go into the graph settings and you adjust the depth offset. And it's something that you got to do for Great Lakes waters all the time. So I went -2 on that offset, and all of a sudden my map was dead on again. And it drew me a whole new map, right? So now it's like, oh, God, well, look at all these new eater spots. Like this looks completely different than what I was looking at. But let's, instead of working our traditional eater spots, let's work the 14 foot that's now created, right? So we did that. And Cullen was at the wheel, and he started working his way up through that structure, the same structure we had just went through. And he had the bait that I wanted on, a Niagara walleye musky candy, he had down. So when I seen he had that down, I put out a night stalker, one, a white belly night stalker that I had caught over 40 fish on, but I hadn't caught one on in a couple of years. I actually thought the bait was dead. And so I put that down, and we're working our way up through that structure. And he makes a turn right as it comes up into that 14 to 12. And that rod just buries. I mean, it goes off as hard as a rod can go off. You know how that Niagara current is. And I mean, that thing just came up, smoked it, and took it straight down. And the fish surfaced kind of far out. And, you know, we got into the bag like we always do. And it was the biggest Niagara fish I've caught. It was 51.5 inches, which Cullen caught a very similar fish up there with me in 2020. And it was, I mean, just an absolute giant, you know, low 40 pound, just tank fat fish, you know, 26 inch girth, probably just a whale. Right. So we're happy as can be. We take the time, we measure the thing, you know, out of this world. That's my third Niagara 50 ever. I've caught a bunch of 49s and 49.5s, but it's tough to crack that 50 mark there. So I'm, you know, out of my mind happy. And then I jokingly say, let's get going. I'm going to get another one.
Yeah.
And 20 minutes later on the button, that same rod got smoked again. And we hadn't even made it back to where the first one ate. We had drifted down in the current during the release process of that one. And we were cutting behind a shelf that was probably came up to 12. And we were cutting behind it in like 16 foot of water, like directly behind it, which we knew because of the cool map that we had just, you know, updated there with the little offset featured thing. And the rod got smoked again. And for whatever reason, this fish looked even bigger. And we put that one in the bag, and we're both looking at it like, holy, what did we just do? And sure enough, that one just made 50. I don't know why it looked bigger in our heads, maybe because it was a little thinner, but it was another tank fish with probably a 24.5, 25-inch girth. And it just got two giants back to back. So we're like, what is even happening? We're like, we're losing it, but now we know we got to get going. So we get that fish released and we start trolling back up through because we knew that there was a ton of marks that we had seen. And I dropped that rod back and I flipped the bail over and it shot off again. And exactly 11 minutes after the second fish, I think we got the third one, which was like, that one was like a 44, which I basically just punted it out of the net as fast as I possibly could because we're just looking for what else Lake Erie had served up for us. But we trolled the rest of the night without anything, but it was cool. It was cool to see what can happen when you catch those pelagic fish coming in to the river system from the lake and you just get that timing right. Because I know there was another good one caught in that area the very next morning. And then probably 2 days later, they were gone. You know, they dispersed all over the place. So it was it's pretty cool to see what can happen in the Great Lakes when those pods of fish show up on a spot. You know, three very good fish in 31 minutes time, which two included, you know, two of my biggest on the Niagara ever. So
amazing.
It was cool. It was a cool night, man. I still enjoy that one just thinking about it for sure.
That's a great story. It also speaks about the bite window when it opens, right? Be ready because you might have only a few chances and you obviously capitalized, but you know, that window, Frank, we always talk about it when the window opens and you just feel like there's at any moment a fish is coming and then you know when it's closed, you have the feeling when it's closed, but you know, you still fish, but you were in that window where, you know, things were hot and you capitalized. And that's a great story. 3-0.
It's funny. You talk about, you know, when that window's closed, man, but that's one of the things you can't do. You can't ever get content. You can't think, oh, I got the good one. It's over. Like that's the worst mistake you can make, especially on a trip is, we got two good ones, man, but the bite's done. When you can eliminate that mindset and stay out there, even though you had previous success in the day, that's when the real magic happens. Like that's when you really can have crazy, crazy days or catch real giant fish. Getting content is probably the worst mistake you can make.
Yeah.
When the big fish are gone, for sure.
Yeah. You have to persevere, man. You have to stay out there and wait for the next window or the next bite. Yeah. You can't be content. You're right.
Which I think sometimes it's easier to persevere when it's bad than when it's good, right? Like when it's tough, you grind and grind and grind and grind. But when it's good, you're like, man, we did good. Let's go back and have a beer. No, forget that, man. Like when it's good, I'm going to stay out until the sun comes back up. Yeah. Like that's where I'm at these days.
Yeah, we're the same. I mean, maybe not till the sun comes up, but we'll beat it to death if we're having good success. And we'll make sure that there's a few hours between that last moment and the nothingness. I mean, because why not, right? You're there to fish. So
no, exactly. Yep.
Awesome. What a cool story.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, man, that was fantastic. Just a great discussion, John. I knew it would be. I thank you so much for coming on. I know we talked and, you know, I know that, you know, maybe when we talked at first, you weren't crazy about the idea, but I really appreciate you stepping up and helping us out today. And I think the listeners are just going to love this show. I know we loved it. So.
Cool. Yeah, no problem, man. It was fun. So
awesome.
I try not to do it too much, just not to draw complete attention on everything that everybody's doing, but we kept it vague enough. It was fun.
I think so. I think there's ways to talk about that. The anglers will get little tips here and there to put in their arrows for their quiver. Awesome. Great time. All right, Chris, anything else from you?
Nothing. We're good.
All right, guys and girls, please leave us a review, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you can. We would appreciate it. Help the show out. If you have a fishing business, big or small, it doesn't matter. We have sponsorship packages for every size operation, from the one-man bait maker to the giant bait and tackle operation or lodge. There is no better way to reach a musky-focused audience mixed with a multi-species listening audience than the Ugly Pike podcast, with our exposure on the Fishing Canada TV show, sponsoring the Get In There segment. This is podcast rates at with TV exposure. And your ad lives in perpetuity in our past episodes. And we're always getting new listeners come in and download our back catalog. So you spend one ad spend and you get exposure for years and years to come. Can't be beat. Reach out to us on social media or via our website, uglypikepodcast.com, if you want to hear more. And that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch with centuries of medicinal use by indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. Find Under the Canopy now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear, from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips and swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories. No matter what species you love to target, from boot to headlamp, Angling Sports has what you need. Their store is massive, and it's just loaded with equipment and apparel. So if you love to go after those big toothy critters like we do, it's a one-stop shop for all pike and muskie tackle. Whether you're looking for trolling rods or casting reels, Angling Sports is always adding the latest and best industry offerings from entry level to higher end. Looking for custom muskie baits? They got them. It's worth the drive to London, so check out their amazing store in person or online by visiting anglingsports.ca and net that PB in style. Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear, from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.